It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfhard. On today's show, we're focusing on winter sports. And for all those Olympics junkies listening, the question on your mind, how do I get my kid on a Wheaties box? The best answer seems to be cool it. Those amazing athletes create themselves. But what parents do and should do is give kids the opportunity to get outside and to compete. In the first half, we'll be talking with folks who train young people to be downhill ski racers at the Alaska Resort south of Anchorage. The program there has gone on for decades and has produced some great competitors, including one of my guests. After that, I have parents who raised some famous athletes, an Olympian and a musher, to find out what they did right or didn't do wrong. And in the last segment, we'll be talking about ice climbing. It's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. Well, we're talking about something I've really wanted to learn about for a long time, which is youth ski racing. Alaska produces some amazing alpine skiers, and most of them come out of one program, which is at Alaska Ski Resort. And they come from a set of coaches and parents and folks who are just involved in raising up skiers from a very young age. It's like a lot of things, it's something you need to get started on early. So we're going to be talking about that today, how kids learn to be skiers. And I've got two guests in the studio today to talk about that. Clint Lentfer is the board president of the Alaska Mighty Mites, which is part of the Alaska Ski Club, which takes kids all the way up through their junior years. And he's head coach at Mighty Mites. Thanks for being here, Clint.
Thank you, Charles.
And Kiefer Christensen is a ski racer who's just started to be a coach with the club. And Kiefer was on the U.S. team for 6 years and won the U.S. Nationals in 2016. And so he can give us the other side of what it's like to come through this program. Thanks for being here, Kiefer.
Thank you very much.
So Kiefer, tell me, when, what age did you start skiing and what age did you start realizing you like to go really fast?
Well, that's before I can remember.
Okay.
I think my parents got me on skis when I was 2. At that point, it's not really much skiing, but kind of pushed me around on skis.
Uh-huh.
And I joined the Mighty Mites when I was 6, which actually I think was a year early then. I was supposed to be in a resort type of learn-to-ski program, and there wasn't enough kids, so I got pushed over to Mighty Mites. And the way I remember it, I was crying, and I did not want to join. I was afraid. My older brother had been a racer. I didn't want to do it, and by the end of the day, I was like, this is pretty fun. I want to keep doing this.
Well, I think part of the whole thing about skiing is getting that natural feeling on skis, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you are learning when you're so small, then by the time you're bigger, it's just second nature, right?
That's right, yeah. I try to coach my parents every once in a while, and when, by the time you're a little bit older, you got to think things through, and it gets a lot harder when you're younger. You just kind of do it and figure it out, and definitely the easier way to do it.
I mean, I've taught a lot of kids to ski. It seems like the fear aspect lasts about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Whereas with adults, the fear aspect lasts a lot longer. Yeah. So, Clint, I'm sure you've taught a million kids to ski over the years.
Taught a lot of kids. I've been coaching for over 20 years.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the club has been around for 50 years.
The Mighty Mites, they were started in 1967 by Jim and Margaret Walker. And we've had some really good success over the years, putting out some great athletes and great people. That's really what it's about.
Have you ever counted up how many kids have gone through the program in total through those 50 years? It must be like thousands.
It's thousands. We had a 50-year anniversary this past fall at the Challenge Alaska building there in Girdwood, and we had close to 300 people come to celebrate the 50-year anniversary with us. I've never sat down and crunched the numbers of how many athletes we put out, but it's a significant number.
Yeah. So what is the key to teaching a kid to ski and to get excited about racing? Obviously, in some sense, skiing is really fun, but it's also one of those sports that it's not fun until you kind of can do it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're not a learn-to-ski program. We're a learn-to-ski-race program. So we don't take the kids that are just learning how to snowplow. We like to take them and teach them some techniques. most of my coaches have prior racing experience, and they what we're after is teaching the kids techniques, running the gates, basic body position, some really important things for ski racing. But you hit the nail on the head. Fun is the key. If the kids kids are not having fun, they're not going to want to come back and continue to do it. So that's primary for our coaches, to make sure the kids have fun while actually learning something out there too.
Yeah. So is it competitive from the start in that sense, or is it like, you know, the trying to win a race from day one, or how do you develop that?
Every kid's different, really. It's interesting you mentioned that. Some kids are real competitive from the get-go, and they want to win everything, and some kids are not as competitive. So we try to find the competitive bug in them and try to pull that out a little bit, because ski racing is a competitive sport. So uh-huh. Some kids find that they really, like Kiefer, really enjoy the competitive part of it and really flourish, and some kids don't take it as far as the other ones, and that's fine. We're out there to introduce them to the sport and basically teach them to learn how to ski and ski race and make it a lifelong sport for them.
So here's something that, you know, we watch the Winter Olympics, and most people don't see ski racing really outside the Winter Olympics, hardly at all. I mean, so some people might go down to Alaska and watch ski racing, but they all look like fantastic skiers. They all look like they're going super fast. And I wonder, when you're evaluating a young person or looking at them in terms of their ski racing skill, what do you see in them? What makes a better ski racer or a less good ski racer? I mean, what are the aspects that you see in them in terms of their technique or their personality or whatever?
Well, Kiefer, kick in too here, but I think attitude is a big one, and physical ability. They're kids, so they learn at such different rates. Mm-hmm. They're going through a lot of changes, and so you can usually tell if a kid's got a great attitude, pretty physically fit, and that's huge with us as well, is just getting them away from the computer and the screen and getting
right.
outside and enjoying the outdoors. That's a huge part of it for
right,
me,
right.
is to teach the kids to love that. But attitude and physical fitness are huge, so I don't
know. And what is that attitude? Just sort of the go-get-em kind of attitude of, like, I want to go as fast as possible?
Yeah, I think that ski racing is kind of cool, unique in a way, in that it's a very individual sport, but to some degree it's a team sport. You know, you're not just out there training by yourself. You're around your friends. So
yeah,
I think
that's probably
a lot of the good skiers, from young to old, it's, that attitude is probably a lot of self-motivation, right? Because when you're out on the course, you know, it's not like you're on a football field or on a boxing ring or whatever, where you're going against someone else and they're kind of pushing you. When you're racing, it's just you on the course, so you have to want to go fast. And, you know, at the end of the day, you get compared to the other people out there. But, you know, basically it's just you wanting to go fast. And that kind of, when you get to at least to a higher level, kind of translates into, you know, going to the gym and tuning your skis and doing all the other stuff that, you know, ends up helping you go fast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Clint was talking about this aspect of putting work into it, right? Yeah. I mean, it's not all fun. Mm-hmm. And what is some of that work part that you're talking about, Clint, where sort of getting away from the computer and getting outdoors? Just spending more time on the hill?
Or? Yeah, well, I think it's just getting the kids to realize there's something other than school and computers and cell phones is the outdoors and the ski racing part that Kiefer and I both have a passion for. Not just the skiing, but it's the racing, it's the competitive side. And it does take a lot of work. He mentioned hitting the weights. Well, the younger kids are doing dry land, they're mountain biking, they're hiking, and we encourage that. You know, when we're in with our Mighty Mite kids, we talk to them about what activities they do outside of school, whether it's biking, hiking, whatever it might be, and then the tuning the skis is the other part of the puzzle. They've got to have good equipment out there to help with their success as well.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about how physical fitness contributes to success as a downhill skier. I mean, I want to hear from both of you, but I mean, it seems like the race itself isn't lasting all that long, right? But you've got to have some muscle and you've got to have some endurance. Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, Kiefer? I mean, pretty much all the way from a younger level to a higher level. I'm obviously at the higher level, it gets a little more calculated.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with ski racing, you pretty much run the gamut between you need to have, you know, stability, so have strength in your muscles, and you need to have, you know, a high-end type of anaerobic thing and a, you know, aerobic type of thing. You need to be pretty well-balanced. It's a little bit of jack-of-all-trades, you know, in terms of dry land training. But I think that's another thing about ski racing that is valuable. You said, like, you know, it's not always fun, which is true to some degree, but I think one of the great things about ski racing is learning, you know, when you apply yourself to something, whatever it is, to like figure out how to make it fun. Because if you want to be a ski racer, you know, we're only racing for a minute or two at a time. So there's going to be a lot of other work outside of that. And if none of that is fun and only the 1 minute's fun, right, it's not going to be that fun of a sport.
Right.
But I think people find that that's not the case because people wouldn't do it otherwise. So you learn to, you know, enjoy mountain biking, enjoy hiking, even, enjoy tuning your skis, whatever, all these little things. And I think especially for a little kid getting back to the Mighty Mites program, I mean, when you're a little kid, you know, everything is done for you. You go to school, everything. Everyone tells you what to do, how to do it. And to some degree, that's true with the Mighty, you know, with racing. You have to be there. There's a certain time, and the coaches might tell you how to ski, but once you're out on the hill, you're pretty much running the show. And so I think that's why it can be empowering for a little kid to kind of, you know, and for an older kid and for an adult to get out there and
have that freedom.
Yeah.
But I think that's true for youth skiing all the way around, right? Because you get out there and you're suddenly in a pretty, you know, there's some stakes to skiing, right? There's always, you always have to use judgment, but nobody's in control of you. You're
right,
like
there's a lot of independence.
Yeah.
That's the other component that we like to teach the kids is self-confidence and independence. Mm-hmm. Those are two key critical components that we take them from a seven-year-old kid when they get up to 10, 11, 12, 13. They have good self-confidence. They've got independence. We tell them to go take a run by themselves. Like Kiefer was saying, these kids are not always being told where to go or what to do. They're able to do it by themselves and make decisions on their own. And we kind of guide them and steer them a little bit. But you're on a big mountain with a lot of dangers out there. You're sitting on it. You have four kids on a chairlift. It's 50, 100 feet down some spots, and it's pretty dangerous. So safety is pretty important as well with us, with the coaches, and with our program. But there's a lot of reliance that we put on the kids, and they recognize that, and it helps them become a better person, and that's important to us as well.
Cool. We're talking about kids ski racing, learning ski racing, and the huge program here in Anchorage, which is called the Alyeska Mighty Mites. And Clint Lentfer, who's just speaking, is the board president. He's also the head coach. And Kiefer Christensen is, a product of this program.
That's right.
And went to the U.S. ski team for 6 years and won U.S. Nationals in 2016, and now he's back in coaching. So what does it take to be in this program? I mean, how many hours are families putting in to the program? And also the money aspect, obviously, is significant because downhill skiing is not a cheap sport.
Yeah, I can probably touch on some of that stuff. The program runs every Sunday, and it starts at about 10:30 and it finishes up about 3:15, 3:30, and we have about a 45-minute lunch break. So it's a full-time commitment for the families that want to do it. Currently, we have 197 kids in the program.
Wow, that's big.
We've had those numbers fluttering around 200 for almost 10 years now. So we're really putting a lot of kids on the mountain and teaching them how to ski and ski race, and that's really, really great for the sport and the program, of course. Touching on the costs, the cost for the program, I believe it's at $250 or $260 per year. We have 17 or 18 sessions per winter, so that's every Sunday, starting in about mid-December, ending in early April, late March, early April. It's kind of snow-dependent on some of that stuff. So it's actually a really, really good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are responsible for their own ski passes, so the parents usually buy a pass, not a single-day ticket, but what we find is a lot of the parents will just bring the whole family up and ski on the mountain while the kid's in Mighty Mites, or one kid will be doing juniors. In most of the programs that we have in the Alyeska Ski Club, including the Mighty Mites, there are siblings involved and they're doing other programs, whether it's a junior racing program, the Devo program, the free ride program, or the Mighty Mite program. So really family involvement. And the parents sometimes even join masters. We have a master's program.
Oh,
for
really?
19 to 99.
Racing program?
Parents, yeah. Kiefer's parents do the Mighty Mite program. At least they have in the past. And so, yeah, we get them from about 7 years old all the way up until they don't want to race anymore.
Wow.
So,
So what's it like working with these little seven-year-olds? I mean, they're a little bit little rugrats.
They are fun. They are a ton of fun, and that's what keeps it's Mighty Mites is 100% volunteer program. There's no paid staff there, and we've had 35 coaches, and we're all volunteer. We all have full time jobs.
Program.
Yeah, it's big. Yeah. So every Sunday they show up, and everybody gets 5, 6, 7, 8 kids. They tag them up a little bit. Sometimes we do larger groups with multiple coaches. But it's 100% volunteer. So our goal is to keep the fees down for the program for the kids. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of sponsorships. A lot of people are behind the program and support the program, which is nice. It helps keep the fees down. But it's a lot of work for myself, the head coach, and the program director, Roberta Carney, as well, to keep the kids coming back, keep them up to speed on what's happening with the conditions, and then myself for keeping track of all these coaches. So,
So Kiefer, you've come back and working as a coach now. Are you like working with these little tiny kids?
No. So I'm actually working with kind of the next step up in the program, the juniors program, and even kind of the older kids within that program. So,
it must be cool for them to work with somebody who's gotten to the high level you've gotten to.
Yeah, it's fun to come back and. You know, Alyeska and Alaska is a great place to learn to become a ski racer and to be a ski racer. But, you know, it's a little bit removed geographically. So it's, I know when I was young, I was always, you know, scrounging for every bit of kind of information from what's going on out on there on a world stage. So it's fun to see, you know, we used to have, I don't know if they still have it actually, but the Tommy Moe Invitational at, with the Mighty Mites and, you know, he was obviously an Olympic gold medalist, so I still have about 100 things in my room with his signature on it. And so that was cool to see. But, yeah, one thing, I guess, even when I was, you know, at the end of my career or whatever, at the high level, all these other stressors and factors start to come in, and I would sometimes try to think about, like, what it felt like to be driving down to Girdwood, you know, on a Friday afternoon, because get back to that feeling.
Remember
I had
the fun,
with the
right?
Mighty Mites. Mighty Mites was such a great program to kind of teach me how to love ski racing and just give, you know, a kid an opportunity to start something to apply himself to.
I bet you felt this incredible anticipation driving down there on a Sunday morning, right?
Yeah, so
I can imagine. So you mentioned the Alyeska being a good place to learn to be a ski racer.
Absolutely.
And obviously it's produced some really good ski racers. You've skied at resorts all over the world as a racer. What are the qualities that make Alyeska special? I mean, it's pretty small compared to some of these places, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't, right? It doesn't have as many lifts and maybe not as many square feet, but for one thing, just about every piece of terrain on the mountain is challenging to some degree. You can do something with it. You go to bigger resorts and you find yourself on cat tracks, kind of going nowhere, having to take multiple lifts just to get to any bit of good skiing. And at Alyeska, there is some, you know, terrain that's a little bit milder for beginners, but
most
of it is, you know, geared towards a skier that is more advanced or wants to become more advanced. And, you know, the conditions are always changing. You don't get a lot of, you know, everything's different, which is really good for a racer because you want to be able to adapt. There's so many variables in skiing. If you get kind of locked into one-dimensional type conditions, you go to a race and the conditions change all the time, and that can be both, you know, physically, you don't know how to ski it, technically, and mentally it can, you know, cause a lot of anxiety. So that was one of my biggest assets whenever I would go ski race. If the conditions were ever a little bit variable or weather would come in, I would say, you know,
you've seen it. Yeah.
All right, this is a good thing for me. And then, you know, I felt like I had to step up on the competition. So right there.
I read an article about a guy who's a big backcountry skier who picked up some young people who were skiing moguls in the Olympics and was amazed that they knew how to ski that one thing that they did, but they were really not all around skiers.
Yep.
In backcountry, they were kind of lost.
Yeah.
But it sounds like that's not you at all. It sounds like you're more of an all-around skier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest assets of racing in Alaska is being able to go up and ski Alyeska and just get so much volume and with a variety. You know, there's a lot of little nooks and crannies that make for really good skiing at Alyeska.
Yeah.
And one thing we shoot for with our Mighty Might program to touch on the racing versus the free skiing aspect, it's about 20% of the time is we're in gates. We just started gates last weekend, and we've been been doing it for 4 or 5 weekends now. So we don't just stand in line and run gates all day. That's not really beneficial to the kids. Like Kiefer said, we're skiing the whole mountain. We're taking 7-year-old kids down the North Face and over on High Traverse. And
wow.
It's amazing to see the level of these athletes. And by 10, 11 years old, these kids can ski anywhere on the mountain, which the big deal in Alaska is if you can ski Alyeska, you can ski anywhere in the world with confidence. And that's mm-hmm. that's 100% the truth. So that's part of our goal as coaches is to introduce them to varying terrain and challenge them, not just make it an easy day going down the blue or green runs, is throw them on a black diamond and let's see how they do here. And sometimes you're cleaning up kids for 20 minutes and putting skis on, and you know, that's part of the deal. But at the end of the day, the kid has a blast. I mean, the kids, that's the funnest part for me, is at the end of the day when the kids are coming down and the parents are scooping them up, when they have snow packed in their goggles, and it's, you know, they're just smiling and giggling, and they're that's what really makes mm-hmm. it fun for me is to see that. So
right, so I'm pretty impressed with that. I didn't realize that you did that. So you're not just teaching them to race, you're teaching them to be a whole mountain skier and to really take on bigger terrain and be able to challenge
them. Yeah, correct. Yeah, ski racing is just one component. Like Kiefer said, it's you're racing in the actual race for maybe 1 or 2 minutes a mm-hmm. day. And the older you get, you need to spend more time in the gates, 50-60% of your time. But at a young age, you're going to burn more kids out by doing gates all the time. The kids need to go out there and have fun. And it's super important, again, like Kiefer touched on, is your strength and your core. If you're standing around waiting to run a course all the time, you're not going to get strong legs. You're not going to get a strong core or get your balance and things like that. So
right.
Skiing all the varied terrain on the mountain is critical, and that's what we're doing with the kids, is not just skiing. Again, the groom slopes, we're taking them off trail, having them fall. My saying is, if you're not falling, you're not learning. So if I that's one of the things I ask the coaches every day is, how many times did your kids fall today? If they didn't fall once, then you weren't pushing them hard enough. They got to fall a little bit to learn, to get better. So uh-huh. that's our goal.
Well, it's you mentioned attitude for the kids, but it's a big factor of the attitude for the coach too, isn't it? I mean, because they're generating this fun atmosphere and they're pushing the kids, but not pushing them too far. And the personality of the coach is really important, I think.
It's real important. And like Kiefer was saying, it's, you know, if the coach isn't having fun, then the kid probably isn't having fun. Mm-hmm. So we've got a number of, I'd say over 50% of our coaches are ex-racers and ex-Mighty Mites. So we've got a lot of people coming back,
yeah.
just like Kiefer did. I grew up ski racing at Alyeska as well. And to me, it's a lot of fun. I want to share the great experiences that I've had on the mountain with other kids and kind of teach them about the fun you can have out there skiing and ski racing.
Cool.
Yep.
So we're obviously talking about ski racing today on Outdoor Explorer, and my guests are Clint Lentfer, who is the board president of Alyeska Mighty Mites, and Kiefer Christensen, a racer who has returned from a successful world career as a ski racer to help coach here in Anchorage. Some parents who are listening, thinking about this, their first thought would be like, "That's too dangerous." Address the sort of the hazards of doing this, Clint.
Yeah, so we have coaches meetings in the morning and we have coaches meetings in the afternoon. We check with the ski patrol. We find out where the hazardous areas are on the hill. And usually we've got 1 or 2 coaches that have skied prior the day before a Saturday. And we know where and where not to go with the kids, because the snow conditions can be variable and dangerous in some areas. So safety, like I said, is one of the big things that we really talk about with the kids. And that's something that I impress on the coaches. And then the coach's job is to transfer what I say about safety and then make sure the kids understand that. And it's not just the conditions, it's the, you know, safety bubble with where you're skiing with the kids. You don't want to get too close to another skier and lose control.
Mm-hmm.
There's no messing around on the chairlift. That's very, very dangerous. We have had kids fall off the chairlift before, not very far, right after they get on, but that's because they were messing around a little bit, and we've really addressed that. Safety on the mountain, for example, no stopping below knolls where you're in a blind spot and somebody comes skiing up above you. Those are all things that aren't necessarily teach them about ski racing, but it's about ski etiquette. It's about being a good steward on the mountain and teaching them how to be safe on the mountain. Mm-hmm. So that's really, really important with us, with our coaches. And occasionally we'll have kids that get hurt, that they break a leg or a thumb or hurt their back or their neck or whatever and have a concussion. And we call the ski patrol. That's what we do. And they come up and assess the situation and go from there. So yeah. Skiing is inherently a more dangerous sport than walking. I mean, I will acknowledge that.
People do get hurt.
It's a lot more fun. So,
You know, what I've noticed is some of these little tots are out there skiing on their own, and they're just like cannonballs coming down the mountain. And somebody needs to pull the kid aside and tell them, like, this is what you're endangering other people as well, because you're skiing like a little out of control projectile. And, I've been hit by some of these little guys. And so in that sense, what you're doing is really good, right?
Yeah, we're trying to educate them.
Just sort of the concept control is the key to skiing. You get just like throwing yourself down the mountain is not what it's all about.
Well, I can assure you that none of those kids were Mighty Mites strong. Mm-hmm.
So Kiefer, tell me about taking this to the next level. How did that sort of develop in your life when you learned, you got into racing? Obviously, you must have loved it from pretty early on.
Yep.
Tell me that sort of, when did you know that you were going to be a ski racer and that was sort of where you want to take your life?
I'd say it was pretty early on. I kind of latched on. I was a total fanatic with watching, World Cup races on TV, which can be, at the time, it was actually, there's ways to do it now also. And at the time, you could do it pretty easily. So I recorded all the World Cup races. I watched, over and over. I was also very lucky because my older brother had gone through them. Both my brothers were racers, and the middle brother was pretty competitive. So he really kind of paved the way for me a little bit, and for my parents too, just in terms of, understanding that basically more is better. You can overdo it. But
sounds just, like this became your family activity.
I kind of got on the early track early, and my parents, they didn't have to push me or anything. If anything, they had to tell me to stop skiing and go do my homework. But
So were you kind of a ski bum?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, when you're a little kid, you just the freedom.
It's all you really cared about. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I just kept working my way up, and it was just, it's such a gratifying thing for a kid or for anything, because it's like so many things in life you can work at and you don't necessarily see the return right away. And ski racing can be, it's a lot of variables, so it doesn't always work out, but for the most part, if you zoom out a little bit, the work you put in will get back to you. So it's really gratifying in that, in terms of finding ways to push yourself that otherwise you probably wouldn't do.
When did you start seeing that success, and getting that feedback?
I mean, Mighty Mites is great because you race quite a bit, and it's a small, there's a series of groups you move up to. And so if you do well in one age group, you move up to the next, not age group, but a kind of ability thing. So that's a great foundation to get that feedback. Okay, I did well. Okay, I move up to the next group. I did well, move up to the next group. And then that translates to it's actually better when you're younger. Once you get older, it's a lot harder to get the trophies, and they get a lot smaller. I skied through the LSC Ski Club, and then eventually made the U.S. ski team right out of high school.
Oh, really?
And was able to do that, and also I'm actually going to finish my college degree back east of Dartmouth this spring. So I was able to kind of chip away one term, two terms a year at that. So, I mean, that's another great thing for any parents. A lot of parents, they might get too involved in it. But it can, if you are successful, it can lead to, you can go ski in college. So that can be a great opportunity.
Yeah, well, I know Dartmouth has a great ski team, and they have a mountain and the whole thing. Was that like a ski scholarship to get there?
Kind of. So, I mean, different schools are different. Not all the schools give actual financial scholarships, but they might, have a kind of, the coaches pull you in a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, I wouldn't have gotten in that without my skiing help. So you can get in. I didn't actually compete for them, but I would attend school there kind of in the off season. But there's Western schools and Eastern schools, and there's you know, a couple tiers. You don't necessarily have to race at, you know, there's multiple right. college circuits. So there's a lot of opportunity there if you're willing to work for it and stay on it through high school. So that can be a great thing, you know, especially in high school. You know, other distractions and forces yeah. start pulling teenage kids in different ways, and ski racing is a good way to kind of keep you on
absolutely
on the straight and narrow while still having a lot of fun.
So did you, when you went straight from high school to the U.S. ski team, is that an unusual way to do it, or is it usually happen older?
No, it varies. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do it. Some guys are much older and some guys are, you know, young like I was. So
I think that would be mind blowing to be like 18 or 19 years old and suddenly traveling around the world on a ski team.
Yeah, it's definitely a cool way to do it. So it's nice to be home.
I think rapid growing up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would, you know, come, you know, and yeah.
So you were like going all over Europe and just going all over the world ski racing
yep,
in all these different
right.
exotic
yep.
places.
Yeah, and particularly
doesn't sound too bad.
Coming from Alaska, you figure out how to, you know, travel by yourself and
mm-hmm.
Even on the U.S. team, you have expenses to pay, so you figure out how to fundraise and book, do logistics and that type of stuff, which at the time kind of just seems like a pain, but now it's, you know, good skills to have.
Yeah, you've got some real experience under your belt. So, Clint, Alaska's produced a lot of big alpine skiers, haven't we? Tom Bimo was mentioned, but, I mean, it's sort of you're the base of the pyramid, and you're actually getting to the top of the pyramid.
Yeah, we're definitely putting out good athletes there, and Kiefer's a great example of that. He's taken it to the highest level. But that's one of the important things. But just like any other sport, football, basketball, whatever it might be, I don't think a coach at a very young level needs to have.
You
don't have to worry about that stuff. If the love is there and the desire is there, the kid will take it as far as they want. Our our job at the Mighty Mite level is to instill that love of skiing and the outdoors and you know, teach them to be independent, resourceful individuals. That's it.
Very cool. Well, thanks to both of you for coming in. I found this really fascinating. Clint Lenfer, board president of Alyeska Mighty Mites and head coach, and has been at it for many years. Thanks for your service, Clint.
Thank you.
That's great. And Kiefer Christensen, honored to have you in the studio. U.S. Ski team member, former U.S. national champ, and now back to being a coach. Thanks for being here, Kiefer.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That's Outdoor Explorer. Please stick with us as we continue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Well, for this segment on Olympic parents, I have a couple of parents that I'm really interested in learning how they turned out some incredible athletic children who also happen to be really bright, interesting, cool people. If you know Rachel Steer, the biathlon competitor who was in the Olympics twice, she competed in 2002 and 2006, and then she came back to Anchorage. She's been on the show before, and is charming and intelligent and well-spoken. As a parent, I look at that and I think, well, how did they do that, right? How do you turn out kids like that? And so I've got Paul and Bonnie Steer here to talk about raising an Olympian and sending her off and then bringing her back from an elite sports career. And thanks so much for being here. Paul, thanks for being here.
Fine, thanks.
Bonnie, thanks
Thank
for coming.
You.
So were you guys really active in skiing or shooting? Paul, was this something that you sort of implanted from the beginning?
Well, when we came to Alaska in 71, we started doing some cross-country skiing, but not anything more than just, you know, mildly recreational.
Uh-huh.
And I took up hunting and fishing.
Mm-hmm.
But we were never really serious participants in the skiing.
Yeah. And your son, Zach, became a really well-known musher who's finished the Iditarod many times. Were you into mushing, or did you sort of like push mushing on him at some point?
That's a whole different story, but no, we weren't into dogs other than a single pet.
Uh-huh. So, Bonnie, when did you recognize that Rachel was going to have this pretty exceptional talent as an athlete? I mean, was it something that was obvious from the beginning?
Not really. She always tagged along with the older sister and brother and did everything well, but she was a determined kid and decided early on just because they liked a certain sport didn't mean she had to, so she kind of branched off on her own. And she loved to ski, and one day was skiing by the biathlon range, and someone let her pick up a rifle, and she knocked down all the targets.
Really? The first time?
Yeah. And she, from then on, she was just a good marksman, and she got interested in it, and from a young age, that was her goal.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying, you know, 14, 15 years old.
Yeah. Did you, was she skiing at Kincaid at the biathlon range out there? Or
yeah, the old range.
The old one, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, which is where the soccer field is now. Yeah, so she must have already had some experience with a gun, right?
I think I had her hunting once.
Really?
Up to that point.
So just natural talent.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm always curious about how much effort it takes to do this and how fast that takes off, and then also how much of that comes from the parent and how much comes from the kid. But maybe you take it first, Bonnie. Was this something that was Rachel's deal, where she was, from the beginning, seemed like she was super focused and really into it? Is it something you had to push her a little
Definitely.
Bit?
Definitely. No, I never pushed her. In fact, it was kind of embarrassing the first time that they had a major biathlon race in Anchorage, and she won the junior division handily. They wanted to send her back to New York for the
Nationals?
A World Cup or something like that.
Wow.
And she didn't even own a rifle. She was using a club rifle at the time, and we hadn't even thought to buy her a rifle. And we sent her off with one that was jury-rigged, you know, a stock from one thing. And, you know, we just didn't know. We didn't know that much
Wow.
about the sport. Women's biathlon was just coming in the 90s as an Olympic sport. Biathlon's been around for a long time, but it was always the men. And mostly military.
Mm-hmm.
And so she saw some of the older people, you know, the kids on the national team, and they became her heroes, and she just went for it.
Yeah, but it takes a lot of time to get up to that level, right? I mean, Paula, I mean, didn't she have to, like, spend tons and tons of time on the range and skiing?
Over the years, she did. And I think it's been written somewhere that to be a world competitive athlete in any sport, you have to put in 10,000 hours. Mm-hmm. I think that's the magic number.
Yeah.
And I would not be surprised if she put in her 10,000 hours before she finally retired.
But that was sort of self-motivated on her part.
Exactly.
Entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that comes from? I'm always asking the nature versus nurture question. It sounds like in this case it was a lot of nature. True? I mean, did she just happen to be a person with a lot of drive?
I think so. We always push the kids to be in sports and extracurricular activities such as swimming and soccer and cross country, things like that, partially to keep them out of trouble.
Uh-huh.
But the drive to continue and to keep competing and to try to get better and better, that was all her.
Yeah, taking it to this high level, it's got to be a special level of drive and of competitiveness. Is she just sort of a naturally competitive person?
She became one.
Yeah.
I wish we could take credit for it, but we didn't do anything special.
Well,
we just supported her mostly.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that's the most important thing. Uh-huh. If you push a kid, they might push back and not want to do it. But if you just are there to support them in their interest, then sometimes it might take off, right?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently she had some natural talent as well.
She did.
Yeah.
And she still does. She's just all three of them are kind of talented in their own respects. And you saw the same thing in Zach, too, with the mushing.
Yeah.
Once he started in, he just took off with it.
So Rachel and Zach are relatively famous. And your other child is, tell me about...
Rebecca.
Rebecca, okay.
She's just as famous in the sports community. Everybody knows Becky and her accomplishments, too.
In what sport?
She's a swimmer, skier, triathlons. She was in college at Bates and excelled in both sports, swimming and skiing.
You seem to have really smart kids too. So that's you make the rest of us very envious.
Paul can take credit for that.
Okay, so. Tell me about having your daughter go to the Olympics. I mean, I think that would be very, very exciting. Also, kind of nerve-wracking. What are your memories of when she first got named to the team and when you saw her, like, on TV and all that? Yeah, go ahead, Bobby.
I was there at Soldier Hollow in Utah, and I was watching the trials. And the first day was not very good, but then she just bounced back and was obviously the forerunner for the other competitors. And I can remember walking out of the stadium and it dawned on me, oh my God, my kid's going to the Olympics.
I know. You know,
it was just, wow.
You must just be floating. Well,
yeah.
When we're watching the Olympics, they always zoom in the camera in on the parent in the stands. Paul, did you guys get to go and actually watch her perform in the Olympics? And what was it? What did it feel like? Was it? I mean, in one sense you think, well, she made it. Whatever she does is fine. But I can't imagine not being kind of nervous.
Yeah, you're really nervous. You're really anxious and nervous when you're watching the competition.
Yeah.
But at least in the first Olympics. Although she was far and away the best American biathlete, she was still a significant notch below the best in the world. And so we were very anxious to see her do well, but we didn't expect, you know, a medal or anything. Mm-hmm. And so it turned out to be a wonderful vacation trip, enjoyment for the whole family.
Yeah, yeah. And then in 2006, she'd raised up to a whole new level, right?
She was more competitive. She had won a couple of podium spots at the World Cups over the previous 2 years and was probably at her peak at that time. And
that was the one in Italy?
In Italy, in Torino.
And what was that experience like? Did you have a great time?
We couldn't afford the opening ceremony tickets. I'll be blunt
about
it. I mean, they're just ridiculously high. But our son, Zach, was there, and he just went to the stadium ahead and found someone that was scalping tickets. The opening ceremony had started, and he called us and said, get over here right away. And by the time we got there, the tickets were down to $50 each. So we got in, and we watched the parade when she came in. I think that was a highlight for me, too.
Yeah.
And we had prime seats for $50 each.
We had to stand. But
some VIP didn't show up, huh? That's great. And then watching the races, what is it like? What's the situation like when you're watching these races there? Do they have it well set up for spectators?
Yes.
So you can really see what's going on.
Biathlon is a big, big sport in Europe, supposedly the number one televised winter sport in Germany, at least. And all the events have a big, you know, multi-foot TV screens and commentators. And there's stands so that you can sit and watch in the shooting areas, or you can stand somewhere along the cross-country course. You're always within sight of a scoreboard that tells you what's happening.
Huh.
So it makes it a real exciting event.
So they really know how to do it and make it appealing to spectators.
And on top of it, the fans... very often are really knowledgeable. So you'll see cheering groups from Norway wearing Viking hats and waving flags, and it's a real social event.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I've read about the Olympics, and you read about the crowds and the transportation difficulties and everything else, but that sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, you'd obviously be very nervous watching your own kid. But.
Well, in Italy, we were staying in downtown Torino, and of course the venue was way up in the mountains, and we had to take a bus to catch a train, to catch another bus.
You know, really?
So it's an all-day event to get out there. But you meet so many great people, and the cultural exchange was worth it for us. And then when people found out, well, we had a daughter who was competing, oh, we were like royalty at some places.
Oh, yeah, I bet you were.
It was fun. Uh-huh. Plus, we got tickets. The Olympic Committee was very thoughtful for parents coming over and provided a house you could go to in downtown, and they'd have lunches there, and they would give spare tickets. So we did a lot of other events we didn't think we'd be able to go to.
What a great experience.
Yeah, it was. It was wonderful. Both times.
So I've wondered about the experience for an elite world athlete retiring from the sport and coming back and going from being sort of the Olympian to just being the mortal, right? And then you've got to get a job, and you've got to sort of, you know, wash your laundry and take out the trash, and people aren't cheering for you anymore. And how did you see, was that a challenge, or did you worry about that, and did you see that transition with Rachel at all?
There was no problem for her. She was ready. She came back. She had her future all mapped out. She wanted to get her degree, and she did it in 3 years here at UAA.
So she had sort of a postponed education while she was competing.
Yeah.
Did you ever worry that she might not complete it?
She was trying to get in a few courses here and there while she was a competitor, but wasn't making huge gains towards a degree.
Because it just take too much time in practicing.
But she had made up her mind as soon as she finished the Torino Olympics, she was going to retire and get her degree and go into real life.
Yes, and I have to admit, I don't remember what her result was at Torino.
She finished in the top 20 in a couple of events. And in retrospect, I think she was happy. At the time, she was disappointed.
Uh-huh.
But in retrospect, I think she was very happy.
Yeah. So but before we finish, what tips do you have for parents who would like to see raise amazing kids like you've done? I mean, you must have been pretty good at it. Maybe you didn't know you were good at it at the time, but do you have anything that you think about, like what you did right? Paul, you want to take that one first?
Well, I think there are three or four factors. One is luck.
that's the top.
That's number one.
Right.
And number two, we sort of decided early on that we would try to keep the kids totally involved in things after school. Particularly in sports where the peer group would be a good group to be with, whether it be soccer or swimming or cross country, were three of the things. So we were steering them towards groups where they had a good peer group, and very lucky.
Mm-hmm. Kids you'd like them to be with, yeah.
We were very lucky because the peer groups our kids ended up with were all pretty highly motivated, good kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you combine that with luck, I think that's what we relied on.
Yeah. Bonnie, anything to add to that?
No, it was pretty much our philosophy, and I'm just so thankful. Many other parents probably do the same thing, and you know,
not many good kids who go to the
same
Olympics
results,
or do.
But, no, I don't think there's anybody that can say I'm going to raise an Olympian.
No,
and do it.
Hopefully,
you know,
not, because if they do, their kid will probably be miserable. Right?
Yeah. No, we just thoroughly enjoyed the ride, and now have grandkids along the way. Now
that's great.
I'd point out one other thing. Mm-hmm. During the time the kids were involved in these sports. I was very busy with my work and spending long hours and often weekends. But Bonnie was there at almost every competition, just giving the support. And I would make a few competitions here and there. But I think her support really made a big difference.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure it does.
I was always the mom at the finish line holding the clothes.
That's a lot of work.
Or at swim meets, you know, sitting there for hours.
Oh, sitting at swim meet is the worst.
Yeah.
It's even worse than just ski meet where you're called.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for coming in. Paul and Bonnie Steer, the parents of Rachel Steer, our own Anchorage biathlon Olympian. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. Outdoor Explorer. Our next segment comes from Southwest Colorado, where the Ouray Ice Festival happens every year, bringing the best climbers in the world to climb in an ice park in a gorge. This piece was produced a decade ago by James Mills, but the festival is still happening every year.
They call it the Little Switzerland of America. Surrounded by high rugged peaks that resemble the Alps, Ouray, Colorado is a classic mountain town. It's nestled in a box canyon at the heart of the San Juan Range. But don't expect to find downhill skiing like in nearby Telluride. Ouray is home to some of the world's best ice climbing.
Reweight my feet here and go ahead and just clip both of them in here to start. Great. Okay. On belay, Mike?
Belay's on.
Climbing on. Climb on.
Every year, thousands descend upon this community of 825 for the Ouray Ice Festival. Over 4 days, climbers scale frozen walls of rock and ice. Armed with ropes, ice tools, harnesses, helmets, and crampons, the climbers practice the subtle arts of winter mountaineering.
That first screw as you pass it.
The event is held at the Ouray Ice Park, a series of frozen waterfalls along a deep river gorge on the edge of town. This year, the Ice Festival drew almost 3,000 participants and spectators to check out the latest equipment, attend seminars on basic and advanced techniques, to see sideshows, and to compete for prizes. With fans watching from elevated observation platforms, 38 climbers, both men and women, ascended the walls using an ice hammer in each hand and stiff boots mounted with sharpened metal spikes or crampons. On a very challenging route, only one made it to the top. Leading international climber Yevgeny Krivochetsev from Ukraine took the prize in this year's rock and ice climbing competition. He said Ouray is the perfect place for this event.
I think it's a great place. And it's great work what the people do for this, I mean, to support ice climbing, just to put the water here. It's really great because it's very close to where the people can stay and enjoy climbing, you know, like 5 minutes walking. It's a unique place, let's say.
Festival director Aaron Eddy said the ice park offers visitors several reasons to come and climb.
The biggest reason is we have over 168 ice climbs in a mile of gorge, and it's very accessible. There's no avalanche danger. You can come and climb for an hour or two in the morning and then go have a cup of coffee 2 minutes away and go soak in the hot springs. It's a really unique resource. It's the only type of its kind in the world.
Local climbers started the festival 12 years ago to share their winter playground and celebrate their favorite sport. With little else to attract visitors through the winter months, retailers like Bill Leo, proprietor of Ouray Mountain Sports, said the ice festival helped put his town on the map.
Well, it gives us a lot of international recognition. That's probably the main thing that it really generates for this town. It gives us a lot of press coverage. Last year we made the front cover of the New York Times during this weekend, and for a little town of 825 people, it's a big thing around here.
As the main economic engine for the winter tourism season, Ouray takes vertical ice very seriously.
My name is Robert Holmes, and I am the low temperature, high altitude creative irrigation specialist here at Ouray Ice Park.
In other words, Holmes is the guy in charge of making ice for the climbers to enjoy. He maintains the intricate system of municipal water that's sprayed into the gorge and allowed to freeze.
It's basically a gravity-fed system, so I'm borrowing water from the city system. It's overflow. I have 150 shower heads basically in here, and two valves per shower head, and about another 40 valves, so about 340 valves takes to run this park on a daily basis.
And that's what brings ice climbers into Ouray from all over the country. Matt Kane traveled from Albuquerque, New Mexico for the Big Ice of Colorado.
Ouray, Colorado is the capital. It has some of the nicest climbs. They're anchored climbs. The top, people up here, they set anchors up top so that we can top rope them. And it's a little safer means for people, friends that we bring along and so on and so forth that don't know how to climb so well. Top roping's a little better way to do it.
Although Kane came for the festival, he said he visits Ouray regularly as well as other areas around the state.
I come up here just for, just to climb. And there's a lot of backcountry climbing here too in the Skylight area, Eureka near Silverton, and Durango area. And so there's a lot of frozen waterfalls all over the place,
But Monica Walker from Grand Junction, Colorado, said the Ouray Ice Park is where it's at.
We love it. It's outstanding. It's a great opportunity to come and demo the gear and climb.
Whitaker said the festival was her fourth time on ice this year and a great opportunity to practice.
Getting better. I'm still not very good at the mixed climbing and the, using your ice tools on the rock, but I'm getting there.
Despite the excitement of the event, climbing still has its hazards. Sam Rushing, a member of Ouray's mountain rescue team, reported at least one casualty.
A lady just had caught a piece of ice with her head. She had a helmet on, and that's about all we know right now, I think. But she's conscious, and she'll be okay.
According to witnesses, the unnamed female climber at the base of a waterfall looked up when climbers above her yelled a warning of a falling block of ice. Described as the size of a toaster, the ice shattered the woman's face shield and helmet, causing apparent facial lacerations and broken teeth. Fortunately, her injuries were non-life-threatening. Rushing said accidents like this are rare, but climbers should take special care to protect themselves.
It's an inherently dangerous sport, and even if you do everything right, Mother Nature never plays by the rules, and that was probably more the case what we're dealing with today. So, get proper training, like anything.
Ice festival activities continued well into each evening. Here, Aline Casarini performs with Doug Allais on guitar as a throng of ice climbers crowd into the Ouray Community Center for a fundraising dinner. Several events such as this, as well as a gear auction and slideshows offered by climbing greats Jack Tackle and Mark Wolfrid, raised several thousand dollars for the development of programs and training facilities for young ice climbers. And a party sponsored by equipment manufacturer Petzl and apparel manufacturer Arc'teryx raised $8,000 for the family of Harry Berger, who died in an ice climbing accident on December 20th. No matter what level of ability, Ice Festival attendees came together to share their stories, throw back a few beers, and celebrate their love of climbing. 65-year-old Ralph Tingey from Anchorage, Alaska, said the camaraderie of the Ouray Ice Festival will keep him coming back year after year.
I climb anything all the time, but so it's not the climbing that's so fun, it's just this whole social interaction here. It's like a climbing gym for ice. And I've seen a lot of old friends, but mostly I've met a lot of new friends here, young people, particularly young, old. Every day that I go out on the ice there, I just kind of wander out, and people pick me up like a stray dog, and take me climbing, and having a great time.
The Ouray Ice Park will stay open through winter, at least as long as the ice lasts. From Ouray, Colorado, this is James Mills.
That's all for Outdoor Explorer. In the first segment, we heard from Clint Lentfer, coach and board chair of the Alaska Mighty Mites, and Kiefer Christensen, a coach and the 2016 Nationals champion. Next, after that, we heard Bonnie and Paul Steer, the parents of 2002 and 2006 Olympian Rachel Steer. My name is Charles Wolforth, Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Hannah Duro is our assistant producer who works on lining up guests. That's all for today's show. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.